This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, March 17th. I'm Max Pringle. Coming up, the Supreme Court to decide whether states and cities can ban trade with dictatorships. Mexican military forces increase their activities in the volatile state of Chiapas, and California environmentalists try to save salmon from extinction. All this and more this week on Free Speech Radio News. The U.S. Supreme Court is set to hear a case which could have far-reaching implications for state and local human rights boycotts around the country. The case, which pits human rights activists against the National Foreign Trade Council, will consider whether Massachusetts can lawfully ban contracts with firms which do business in Myanmar, formerly Burma. The National Foreign Trade Council says the Massachusetts law banning trade with Myanmar enters the area of foreign policy, which, they say, is the reserve of the federal government. If the court strikes down the Massachusetts law, it could wipe out 36 similar state and local laws across America. Matt Martin has that story.
Daniel O'Flaherty is the vice president of the National Foreign Trade Council, the coalition of more than 600 American corporations which has taken the state of Massachusetts to court over its boycott of companies that do business in Burma. O'Flaherty says the NFTC isn't challenging just this statute, but all those like it.
This is an example of a practice that was common during the 1980s and early 90s with respect to South Africa. And then again in the late 1990s, resurfaced with respect particularly with Burma, but also with Indonesia and Nigeria and a couple of other countries. So our member companies felt that it was important to establish once and for all whether or not states could attempt to influence the foreign policy of the United States and make foreign policy themselves by putting pressure on foreign governments through these kinds of statutes.
Representative Byron Rushing, author of the Massachusetts Burma Law, denies it amounts to state interference in foreign affairs.
If we passed the law in Massachusetts that said that all Massachusetts-based companies could not go to Burma, that would be an attempt to do foreign policy. That would clearly be unconstitutional, and we wouldn't do it, and that's not what this is.
Georgetown Law Professor Robert Stumberg filed a brief on behalf of Massachusetts. He says that when states make their purchasing decisions, they have the right to avoid commerce they consider immoral.
The Supreme Court has repeatedly recognized that state governments, when acting as market participants, have equivalent rights to private corporations.
Byron Rushing first backed selective purchasing during the struggle against apartheid in the late 1980s. He says local and state laws in the U.S. had an impact on the South African regime.
You know, I don't think it's going too far to say that Mandela might still be in jail if there was no international movement. And what that means is that you had to get lots of places to put pressure on companies throughout the world to get out of South Africa. And what Massachusetts did then was to join that movement.
When asked if state and local purchasing regulations aimed at apartheid were unconstitutional, the Foreign Trade Council's O'Flaherty says yes.
They would be unconstitutional. They may be morally very legitimate, but the point is that these jurisdictions are not authorized by the Constitution to make foreign policy.
So why didn't business challenge selective purchasing in the 1980s? Professor Robert Stumberg.
These laws are not new, but the lawsuit against these laws is new. 15 years ago, there was not an effective corporate coalition. They did not have as much political clout as they do today, and they did not have the global trade agreements to cite as the underlying problem of foreign affairs which led to this constitutional complaint.
Indeed, it was a conflict with other trading partners, not Burma itself, which the business coalition cited as the foreign affairs issue at stake. The European Union and Asian governments charged that the law violated World Trade Organization rules on government purchasing. Stumberg says that if trade is valued over human rights, the military government in Burma will undoubtedly benefit. He says the regime uses the foreign exchange gained through trade to buy the weapons it uses against its own people. But Jane Jerome, whose work with the Bay Area Burma Roundtable helped put selective purchasing laws on the books in San Francisco, Oakland, and Berkeley, says the invalidation of the Massachusetts law would have an impact beyond the movement for democracy in Burma.
If these laws are taken away, if we're no longer allowed to do that kind of organizing, it really removes a powerful tool that just plain folks have for participating in the global economy and saying what their values are locally.
Lower courts have ruled in favor of the NFTC, and its position recently received the backing of the Clinton administration. If the court is to uphold the Massachusetts law, it will be with the support of the court's most conservative justices, who have consistently defended states' rights against federal encroachment. The court will hear oral arguments on the case on Wednesday and is expected to issue its ruling in June. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Matt Martin.
Mexican human rights groups are reporting that the Mexican military is stepping up activities in the volatile southern state of Chiapas. Activists say new bases and control points in pro-Zapatista rebel areas signal a new aggressive stance for the military. Meanwhile, Zapatista National Liberation Army sources report that pro-government paramilitaries have killed two Zapatista supporters near the Chiapas village of Oventique. And, as Lee Robartis reports, a violent conflict may be in the offing.
A public feud erupted this week when the outgoing coadjutant bishop of San Cristobal said there has been an alarming increase in the number of paramilitary groups operating in Chiapas in the 2 months since his removal from office by the Pope. The bishop, who's also a human rights advocate, alleged the paramilitaries are working in tandem with police in the state's conflict zones. On Tuesday, the Chiapas Attorney General and the Federal Coordinator for Dialogue in Chiapas strongly denied the charges. The state attorney general called on the federal attorney general's office to forcefully investigate once and for all whether such groups exist and act quickly to dismantle them if they do. The existence of such groups is old news to members of CEPAS, or International Service for Peace. The group's new report, publicized nationally Monday, says the space for negotiation has practically disappeared in Chiapas and says they don't discount the possibility that the Mexican government may move toward a military solution between the July 2nd presidential election and the December inauguration. Presidential candidate Fernando Labastida Ochoa of the ruling Institutional Revolutionary Party has suggested that the National Zapatista Liberation Army could be integrated into the state police force and become a legitimate political party if they lay down their arms. EZLN sources call the idea offensive, since it doesn't address the poverty and repression which are the causes of the conflict. The other top presidential contender, Vincent Fox, of the center-right National Action Party, said Tuesday he will negotiate only with the Zapatistas if elected, distinguishing them from other guerrilla groups operating in the states of Guerrero and Oaxaca, which he says act in an isolated and violent manner and don't clearly express their cause. For Free Speech Radio, I'm Lee Robartis in San Cristobal de las Casas, Chiapas, Mexico.
As the war in Chechnya rages on, the Russian government and press have been claiming that victory over Chechen separatists is imminent. All the while, Western news reports of continuing Chechen resistance and Russian military atrocities continue to pour out of the region. I spoke with Boris Kagerlitsky, senior research fellow at the Center for Comparative Politics at the Russian Academy of Sciences. I started by asking him his perceptions of Russian government and media pronouncements about the conflict. He told me about the Moscow apartment buildings that started the current Chechen war.
We know that two newspapers starting discovering more and more evidence about the participation of the security agencies in these explosions. One newspaper is Novaya Gazeta, to which I contribute my own articles, for example. It's a kind of radical progressive newspaper in Moscow, which comes out twice a week. And, for example, just yesterday, it was attacked electronically, so its server was put out of order and the newspaper failed to come out this Thursday. We absolutely know that people in the hackers community in Moscow are not responsible because these are kind of libertarian, anarchistic-minded people who very much sympathize with Novaya Gazeta and what it says. So most logically, you can look for the guilty ones elsewhere, like in the same security apparatus. In the case of another newspaper, Versia, the situation is much more dramatic because Versia, I think, it started digging much deeper than Novaya Gazeta into this story. And also it has its own presence on television through another program called Top Secret, which is owned by was owned by the same person who actually controlled Versia and Top Secret newspaper and TV program, Mr. Boravik and Artyom Bararik. And a few days ago, as you know, Artyom Bararik died in a plane crash. Also, there are many reasons to suspect that that was not just an accident, it was a terrorist act. And once again, you can easily suspect who were behind it.
Well, we know that President Putin is a former KGB man. Do you think these orders might have come from him to kill Artyom Bararik?
I don't know whether Putin personally is involved. I doubt it. First of all, I don't think that the president of the state personally gives orders like that. Also, it would be very counterproductive because generally the head of the state or even the head of KGB, whatever, used to just give general instructions of what is to be achieved, leaving the work of finding the solution on their people below them, and thus also avoiding responsibility, because if something goes wrong, the ones who are responsible are not the ones who gave the general line, but the ones who discovered or thought out some improper solution, you know.
Well, we have elections coming up, and it seems clear that Vladimir Putin will become the next president. How do you see this this playing out as far as the war in Chechnya goes? Do you see an end in sight?
Well, the only perspective for the war is that sooner or later we're going to lose it. And it's not because Russia is so weak, but because the Russian army is not really stimulated to fight this war, and the generals are totally incompetent, and the government never had any strategy in Chechnya, because they just needed Chechnya as a pretext to have early elections, to create this propaganda offensive against our own population. And in that sense, they had no strategy to win the war. And while you have no strategy to win the war, you're losing it. That's quite logical. So sooner or later, we will have to put out our troops. And that will leave us in a very bad shape, and the Chechen society is totally destroyed, so it's very hard to predict what is going to happen to Chechnya itself.
Boris Kagarlitsky, Senior Fellow at the Institute for Comparative Political Studies at the Russian Academy of Sciences, thank you for joining me today.
Okay, thank you.
Goodbye. Florida Governor Jeb Bush is vowing to raise private funds in order to ensure that 52 children in Pensacola can remain in private schools now that a circuit judge has declared the state's school voucher program to be unconstitutional. From radio station WMNF in Tampa, Rob Laurie has this report.
On Tuesday, a state judge ruled that Florida's school voucher program, the nation's first statewide voucher program, was unconstitutional. It's the centerpiece of Governor Jeb Bush's education reform plan. It offers school vouchers to pay for a private education to all students in public school if the school receives an F rating by the Florida Department of Education. This week, a judge in Tallahassee said the voucher program violates the state constitution by providing taxpayer dollars to private schools. The ruling allows 52 elementary school students in North Florida who attend mostly Catholic schools to finish the school year, but prohibits the state from continuing the voucher program next year. In the wake of the ruling, the next step is an appeal. Ultimately, the Florida Supreme Court is expected to decide. Only two schools in Florida have an F grade and thus qualify for the voucher program. If the Florida Supreme Court approves vouchers, 78 schools are in danger of failing next year. 60,000 students attend those schools, and if everyone chose to accept a voucher, it would cost the state $198 million. That's not very likely, though. So far, Florida's program has attracted only about 10% of the eligible children. School vouchers have been tried only in two other areas. In Cleveland, Ohio, 3,700 children attend private schools using tax money. Most of the schools are religious, but a judge there has ruled the program violates the constitutional separation of church and state. That decision is now being appealed. In Milwaukee, 8,000 students attend private schools using vouchers, and the United States Supreme Court has refused to hear a challenge to that program. Democratic opponents of Florida's Republican governor say that he should better spend his time raising money to improve the state's entire school system, but the governor is promising to raise private money to keep the 52 students in private schools and to appeal the voucher decision. Some Republicans are also proposing a constitutional change which would take away the prohibition on spending public money on private schools. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Robert Lurie in Tampa, Florida.
The California State Board of Forestry this week took steps to protect the North Coast's dwindling salmon population. Newly adopted rules were put in place to stem the tide of a huge drop-off in the number of salmon in the state's rivers and streams. Environmentalists say the 85% salmon population drop-off in the last decade is due to unrestricted logging practices in the area. But, as Aaron Glantz reports, the state's decision is meeting stiff resistance from logging interests.
That's the sound of two dozen logging trucks circling the state capitol with lumber in tow. Some 200 timber industry workers came down to Sacramento to protest new logging regulations that are designed to protect the salmon. Republican State Senator Tim Leslie of Roseville spoke to the crowd.
It would appear that the people who make these proposals are more concerned about fish than they are rural families, the hardworking mothers, fathers, and children of the rural communities of California.
Republican Assemblyman Rico Aller of the Central Sierras told the crowd the new rules would cost California's rural north 8,000 jobs.
I doubt if they'll be satisfied until every mill and every logger in this state is unemployed, every mill is shut down.
Many loggers who came to the hearing said they feared the new rules. Glenn Grabian runs a bark stripping machine at a mill in the Sierra foothills.
Well, they already got rid of our night shift about 3-4 years ago because of the way the industry kind of everything got smaller and smaller, just trying to stay alive.
Grabian says he goes to bed most nights worried about his job. Under the plan, timber companies would have to notify state, federal, and local agencies before they log near rivers and streams. Logging on steep slopes will be restricted, as will logging near rivers during the rain. Environmental groups say the rules don't go far enough. Paul Mason is executive director of the Environmental Protection and Information Center, or EPIC, which has sued the state for violating the Federal Endangered Species Act.
These rules don't protect the salmon enough to prevent them from going extinct, and that's the factual scientific bottom line. So we're holding out and we're continuing to move for having more protective rules that will save the salmon from extinction.
California's Democratic Governor Gray Davis says he's trying to broker a real compromise between timber and environmental interests, an impressive balancing act that would end three decades of strife in California's rural north. For the most part, Davis has preferred to offer landowners tax incentives for protecting salmon rather than forcing them to do so through increased regulation. But Paul Mason of the Environmental Protection and Information Center says such a calculation between jobs and the environment leaves out the fishing industry, which has been decimated by the dwindling number of salmon in California streams.
That's something that gets dropped out of this equation sometimes. There used to be 10,000 commercial fishermen on the North Coast. It was a $1 billion-a-year industry. It's gone. There is no commercial fishing left in California.
The Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations is one of the co-plaintiffs in EPIC's lawsuit.
The fishermen are gone. I mean, you know, they're in the unemployment line. They're out there trying to, you know, find alternate jobs because they're not as politically organized. I mean, Big Timber is like maybe five big companies that pull a lot of political weight. And the commercial fishing industry is 10,000 people who aren't that organized, each with their little boat and, you know, their own little family business. They got steamrolled in the political process. They took the entire brunt of the salmon going down. And now we're just trying to get the timber industry to be realistic about it and say, okay, you know, we are part of the problem.
Mason says environmental groups will continue to press their case in court. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz in Sacramento.
First Lady and New York senatorial candidate Hillary Clinton is calling for increased federal funding for research into new gun tracking devices. Clinton says scanning devices would reduce the need for the police to stop and search suspects, thereby reducing the risk of another shooting incident like the one that led to the death of African immigrant Amadou Diallo. Clinton released her statement as part of a criticism of New York City Mayor and Senate campaign rival Rudolph Giuliani's policing policies. As Free Speech Radio's Robert Knight reports, the technology Clinton speaks of is already in existence and has been the target of those concerned with privacy and civil liberties.
According to the 1998 National Institute of Justice Annual Report to Congress, published last December, several technologies are in use or being tested. Among them, low-power X-rays that penetrate clothing but do not penetrate the body. The X-ray device has been demonstrated at a Los Angeles courthouse, at the U.S. Capitol, and at a correctional facility in North Carolina. Two more techniques involve the exposure of targets to an electromagnetic pulse to induce radio signatures from metallic objects, and millimeter wave imaging technology, which could frisk a crowd from as far away as 90 feet, using multiple radiation sources to return real-time computer-generated images of an individual's body parts and/or possessions. David A. Harris is a professor of law and values at the University of Toledo College of Law and a recently appointed Soros Justice Fellow. He is also the author of a seminal paper on the new surveillance technologies titled Superman's X-ray Vision and the Fourth Amendment. According to Harris, the new remote sensing technology carries a mixed blessing.
There are benefits on the police officer's side. The police officer doesn't have to get into the zone of danger. And there are benefits to the suspect in that the suspect doesn't have to be touched by a stranger, doesn't have to be publicly patted down, which can be embarrassing and humiliating. Now, the catch is, if these things are simply put on top of squad cars, then anybody can be frisked. And I think now we need to ask ourselves, under what circumstances should these devices be used? Anytime a police officer wants to, without any cause at all? Or perhaps just when the police officer would normally have the legal right to frisk now?
Dr. Harris says the new gun detection technologies raise a number of constitutional and, in some cases, health issues.
They shoot X-rays or other penetrating waves toward a person. Now, they may be very low doses, but I think you're going to have a real issue there just in terms of health and in terms of safety. But the problem under the Fourth Amendment is that there is a whole bunch of law that seem to say that very unintrusive searching devices, such as, for instance, the canine nose trained to sniff drugs, that those kinds of devices where a person would not even know they're being searched do not constitute a search for constitutional purposes. The problem with that line of thinking is that that means, essentially, that these devices can be used in a completely unregulated way. That, of course, means that they can be used anytime and in any situation police officers might want, whenever they feel threatened, they think there's a weapon, or just because. That, of course, invites abuse.
Moreover, remote detection of a gun does not necessarily mean criminality, since the sensors would not detect a legal concealed carry permit, for instance, nor necessarily protect undercover officers of color in a racially charged moment. Overall, Dr. Harris recommends extreme caution before taking up Clinton's proposal full force, since fundamental issues of police supervision and racial profiling remain unresolved by technological fixes.
Before we deploy the technology, what is it we want our police to be doing? Do we want them searching everybody who happens to be out on the street at their whim? I think if people knew that total strangers could produce images of their bodies under their clothes, they might feel that that is an intrusion and that that is getting into something private, and it is only a matter of time until the technology is that good.
Dr. David A. Harris is a Soros Justice Fellow and Professor of Law and Values at the University of Toledo Law School. Meanwhile, as Hillary Rodham Clinton joins the debate on police practices in New York City with a technological fix, the Justice Department continues its gun detection program in collaboration with the Department of Defense Joint Program Steering Group, the National Law Enforcement and Corrections Technology Center for the Northeast Region, and the United States Air Force Research Laboratory in Rome, New York. I'm Robert Knight in New York.
Free Speech Radio News is a production of Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship. Over 40 Pacifica reporters from across Europe, Asia, and the Americas have been on strike for over a month to protest censorship of legitimate news stories at the Pacifica Network News. These reporters are putting their livelihoods on the line. To find out more about the strike, go to www.savepacifica.net/strike. That's www.savepacifica.net/strike. Free Speech Radio News is produced by Aaron Glantz and Andrea Sears. Matt Martin is distribution coordinator. Technical assistance from Bob Mason and Josh Thayer. Thanks to the National Radio Project for leasing us space. I'm Max Pringle. Thanks for listening.